Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I'm happy to welcome Angela Dinker, speaker, journalist, and author of the book, Red State Christians, Understanding the Voters Who Elected Donald Trump. So thank you, Angela. Welcome to Mindshift Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So what is your backstory? One of the things I left out in the introduction was that not only are you a speaker, journalist, and author, you are also a Lutheran pastor. Now, what's your backstory? What led you to write this particular book as a Lutheran pastor?
So my career as a writer actually began in the world of sports. I was a sports writer for about 5 years, was a hockey beat writer actually, but also covered, you know, the Super Bowl, lots of big sporting events, and had also always been a person of deep personal Christian faith, grew up in the Lutheran church, but also had sort of dabbled in evangelicalism as well. And so working in journalism, left journalism. I'll give you the Cliff Notes version of this story.
Yeah, thumbnail sketch.
Yes. But even though I had such a wonderful experience in sports journalism, I still really felt called to not only tell the truth, you know, because as a journalist, I felt like I was called to expose the truth, and by telling people stories, by talking to athletes, to expose the truth, but I felt like I couldn't expose also the truth of the gospel. So that's really what led me to leave sports writing and go to seminary, become a pastor. And then after a couple of years of being a pastor, serving churches in Las Vegas and in Chicago, I felt myself drawn back into the public realm through writing about often sports, social issues, and religion in American life. So I began to do that more approaching the 2016 election. And then during the 2016 election, I was serving in my third church as pastor at a large evangelical style Lutheran church in conservative Orange County, California, and just watching sort of the fallout from Trump's election in that church and seeing kind of a microcosm of so many of the issues that kind of invaded American evangelicalism when it collided with Trumpism. I got to really see that through the eyes of a pastor in this community that was heavily evangelical. And so then I actually, we moved back to Minneapolis, which is where I grew up, for my husband's job and to be near family. And I had this opportunity to do more writing when I wasn't serving in such a large congregation. And I actually approached Fortress Press with a proposal for a book called Bibles and Boojobs, focusing in real closely on Orange County Christianity, because so many, as we'll probably talk about, so many of the large movements in American evangelicalism, surprisingly for many, begin in Southern California.
The Sun Belt.
Yes, yes. And just, you know, the conservative culture that lives alongside the liberalism. So then Fortress Press, knowing my background as a journalist, they really kind of persuaded me to say, let's not just focus on Orange County, but let's do a whole book looking at the breadth and variety of Trump's Christian coalition from the eyes of a pastor and of a journalist.
So you're a Christian, you're a pastor, but do you focus specifically on the evangelical support? Because I notice the actual subtitle of the book is just says, Understanding the Voters Who Elected Donald Trump. We know that it was the infamous 81% white evangelical vote, but obviously there was a load of other people who weren't evangelicals or whatever that did vote for Donald Trump. Does your book take aim mostly at evangelicals, or is it more broad than that?
Yeah, and I think so much of what we're talking about and what we continue to talk about when we talk about religion and politics is really breaking down words and what those words mean. So I'm a pastor in the evangelical Lutheran church in America, which would not necessarily be considered politically evangelical. So I always want to broaden the understanding of what it looks like to be an evangelical. I think it's turned into a political term, but originally in the Bible, evangelical simply means to speak about the gospel. So as a Lutheran, you know, we always try to pull back from the political implications of being evangelical. But to answer your question, one of the things that I did want to do in Red State Christians, the initial subtitle was Meet the Voters Who Elected Donald Trump. I really just wanted to tell stories of people across the country and to expose the diversity that existed among Christians who voted for Trump, whether they were evangelical or not, and what it meant for them to be defined as evangelical, because an evangelical in Orange County looks very different than an evangelical in Alabama, than an evangelical possibly Catholic, because Catholics were a big part of the coalition. So I just wanted to, in my book, break down some of the maybe stereotypes, while at the same time exposing some of the broad generalities that do exist among this coalition of voters, no matter where they're located geographically or theologically.
Right. So what is the thesis of your book? Is it more of a sociological task? Because I just finished reading Perry and Whitehead's book, Taking America Back for God. Now, they're both sociologists, and so they base their research on a lot of like the Baylor religion surveys and things like that. And they've come up with categories that seem to fit, whether you're talking about evangelical supporters of Trump or people who reject or resist. Is that what you're trying to do? Or are you actually trying to talk people out of being Trump voters or what?
Yeah. I think in some ways, my book defies the idea that it has a solid thesis, in which sense it's much more of a journalistic study that tends to be qualitative rather than quantitative. But Andrew Whitehead is someone who, when we were both in the process of writing our books, he and I had been in touch, and sort of, I think our books make a nice companion to one another, because a lot of the people who are writing about these phenomenons about religion and politics in America tend to either be academics and really approaching it from that quantitative academic type lens, or they tend to be very conservative people who are writing with the aim of defending the voters. And I really was not in either one of those camps. But one thing that I think is important within my book is that you really get not only maybe a sociological or a numerical view of Christian nationalism, as you might in Taking Back America for God or the Power Worshippers, but you also get to see it from a theological lens and to understand a little bit more about what role belief and theology play in different ways for people who voted for Trump and for the leadership of conservative Christianity in America.
I was going to say, because people have been spilling a lot of ink probably since about 2015, really, when it became more and more clear that not only was Trump going to get the Republican nomination as the presidential candidate, but also the fact that more and more specifically evangelical leaders were falling in line of having their support for him. So have you gotten any pushback from evangelicals, you know, since your book has come out?
Yeah, I definitely have. And I think, you know, being a hockey beat writer prepared me for getting a lot of
getting in plenty of fights.
Yeah. So, hey, I mean, I'm not too moved by it. I appeared on CNN at the end of 2019 to talk specifically about one of the people who I interviewed in my book and visited her churches, Paula White, who has been one of Trump's closest sort of advisors, pastors, when it comes to religion. And so I was speaking about the ways in which Christian nationalism and this understanding of faith and religion as a vehicle for political power has become a dominant theme of American Christianity. After that appearance was probably the most intense experience I had of online blowback. But also, I think being a pastor, you know, really, I mean, people always have something to say about your sermons. And I think that I really am of the belief that if you're not saying anything that people are not offended by, then you're probably not saying anything, period. So I will say on the positive side that prior to COVID-19, I had been doing a lot of travel and speaking about my book in churches and at Christian colleges, at some secular colleges as well. But a lot of the speaking and events that I had been a part of for my book were in heavily evangelical and heavily conservative communities. And in those face-to-face events, especially at churches and at colleges, people were very willing to engage with my book, with talking about Christian nationalism, with talking about faith and politics. And so for me, that was really encouraging. And that was something that just reminded me that I think sometimes we get a certain idea of who a Christian who voted for Trump is and what they might think. And people are much more complex than they're often portrayed as.
Exactly. And that's one of the things I picked up from the power worshipers, Catherine Stewart. She talks about there's a difference between the people at the top, those evangelical leaders, and those massive, powerful organizations like the Family Research Council, Focus on the Family, and you know all these massive organizations that got deep pockets, versus what she calls the sort of foot soldier, the person sitting in that pew in any town USA church. They don't know necessarily the agenda of some of these massive Christian nationalist organizations. They're just going out thinking they're doing the right things, you know, helping people to get registered to vote and picking up the phones and handing out flyers. But they're being motivated by some of these people at the very top, and they may not be aware of all the motivations behind it. Did you find that that was the case?
Yeah, definitely. And also the immense amount of power and money and resources that are clustered, you know, at the top. And so I think that that was something that I wanted to do in my book, was just expose that. And I think we've continued to see this as Trump's presidency has continued, is that there's a very strong concentration of a base for Donald Trump. But there were a lot of also people who may have been Christian, who may have been identified as evangelical, who voted for him, who were really different than Robert Jeffress or Franklin Graham. And so I went out of my way to talk to those folks. One of my chapters, I went to Houston, which is one of America's most diverse cities, and also one of the cities in America that's heavily evangelical. And in that chapter, I focused on spending time with Middle Eastern Christians, many of whom supported Trump in 2016 because of his rhetoric against ISIS. And many of them had been victimized by ISIS in their home countries. Many of them were fairly recent immigrants to America. So I think that one of my passions as a writer and as a journalist is to tell stories that aren't being told and to expose people who are not getting to, you know, I think we tend to go to the same people, the same stories over and over again. And I wanted to tell stories and introduce people to folks who weren't being exposed anywhere else.
And I suppose even if you disagree with them politically, it's helpful to be able to understand a different person's point of view, isn't it? Even if you say, okay, I don't support why you voted for Trump, even if I disagree, you can say, okay, at least it's not just that you were swallowing the rhetoric from Fox News or Breitbart or whoever it was. They may have had in their minds legitimate reasons. Did you find any sort of common patterns as you went across America and talking to the sort of rank and file Trump voters? Did you find any sort of commonalities?
Yeah, I will say that. And I'll also mention too that a big part of my motivation beyond being a pastor and being a journalist, there was also personal motivation for me. And that's because my family is very divided politically. And some of my closest family members are heavy Trump supporters and evangelical Christians and friends of mine as well. I went to undergrad at the University of Missouri, and I would say most of my friends from college, most of the people that my husband went to high school and college with, fit into this category of voters who I was attempting to write about. So for me, this was really personal. And it was something that I also saw as a pastor, was the breakdown of family relationships in the face of political division. And so it was really important to me that this would be a book that would potentially be read by those rank and file evangelicals, and you know, that would maybe have the opportunity to shift some people's thoughts in a way that a book, you know, I didn't want this to be a book only for liberals, which unfortunately happens that book, you know, books end up being either only for liberals or only for conservatives. And I just didn't want that the case.
The country is so deeply polarized right now. That's the thing, isn't it? That we can't talk to each other without it devolving into a full-on argument. I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day, and she said that they went and visited her grandparents for the first time since they were starting to ease the restrictions on the lockdown. And her grandfather is the sort of stereotypical Trump supporter voter that you think of when you hear the media stories, as you're talking about the Fox News, the Breitbart. He's in that echo chamber. It's all conspiracy theories. And they got into a huge argument and had a big falling out, and they hadn't seen each other in months. And that was the first thing that happened, was a giant falling out over Trump, politics, Christianity, the whole thing. so they can't even talk to each other. These are close formerly close family members. So yeah, it's a huge problem, isn't it?
Yeah. And I see that in some ways as media manipulation and just the immense power, which I think Stuart writes about too, is that immense power of Christian right-wing media. So again, I wanted to break some of that down, and that was a pastoral and a faith-based motivation for me as well, because I feel like as a follower of Jesus, that we are called not to dehumanize one another. And I think that there's been a mass dehumanization based on political viewpoint in America. And all it's done is hurt the weakest among us and the most already victimized.
Racial lines as well. Obviously, we're seeing that now after the George Floyd, you know, murder. And all the stuff that's come up with Black Lives Matter and the protests and the counter reactions against it and on and on and on. It's just another way to polarize America and the world, even, because we're seeing over here in the United Kingdom, there's been demonstrations over the George Floyd incident, you know, so it's gone around the world even.
Yes. And that was 4 miles from my house. So I've been certainly something that's been important to me, and I've been attempting to write about racial justice. That was kind of my first entree back into the writing world, was writing about Colin Kaepernick as a pastor and a former sports writer. And that's one of, you asked about common trends. That is a common trend that I do want to mention throughout my work and research and interviewing, is that I think as particular as white American Christians look towards, okay, what is the future of American Christianity if we're attempting not to be Christian nationalists, if we don't want to use our religion to make America into a Christian kingdom. And if Theocracy. We also want, right. And if we also want to maintain something that I believe in, which is that the Bible and the Word of God and the example of Jesus do have something positive to offer to American political life and discourse. A place that I think white Christians really need to look is to Christian communities and Christian leaders of color, whether it's the Black church and the long history in the Black church of fighting for justice, whether it's the Latino church and its long advocacy for workers and for people who have been living in poverty, particularly found, you know, in Catholic Latinos or Latino evangelicals. So that was a consistent source of inspiration for me. And as you read Red State Christians, you'll see again and again, voices of leaders of color, particularly I spent time in El Paso at the U.S.-Mexico border at the time when American political world was erupting over children being forced to be separated from their parents and put in detention centers at the border. In El Paso, I was really inspired to see the ways that Latino evangelicals, Latino mainline pastors, we're working together to be a voice for humanitarian concern and for the gospel in the midst of a really explosive situation, which of course made the shooting in El Paso then several months later just absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah, even more poignant and sad.
Absolutely.
Those stories about the evangelical Latinos in El Paso, you probably aren't going to see those on the mainstream media. You're seeing the stories of the families in these detention centers, which was shocking enough for sure. It's absolutely terrible what goes on. Well, I wanted to go back around to this issue of Christian nationalism, if we could. One of the quotes that really jumped out from your book, you said, quote, "I refuse to whitewash the troubling incidents I witnessed and heard during the course of my research, primarily among pastors and media figures, among wealthy and powerful people. I heard people use Christianity to justify American Christian nationalism that would seek to harm the weak among us, refugees, the poor, women, people of color, the LGBT community." You go on to say, "These manipulative pastors and Christian leaders wanted money, power, and control, and they saw Trump as a means to those ends," end quote. So can you comment on what this thing of American Christian nationalism is? How do you define it? Does it pose a threat, not just to Christians, but non-Christians alike?
Yeah, absolutely. And for me as a pastor, what's also really troubling about Christian nationalism is it totally perverts the gospel, and it totally takes away from the message of Jesus, which was the exact opposite, to be savior to the poor and not to continue to victimize the poor and the oppressed. So I think it does everything the opposite of what Christianity is meant to be. But every time that I speak about my book, I tend to speak about four things. I speak about opportunity, and I speak about hope, and I speak about surprise, and I also speak about warning. And so the biggest warning throughout my research in my book, even as I found these stories of hope and encouragement among American Christians, Christian nationalism is the biggest warning in the midst of that. And so the beginning of me understanding the force of Christian nationalism began when I attended the March for Life in Washington, D.C. in 2018 and met with a Southern Baptist pastor named Dean Ancera. He's on the leadership board of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is led by Russell Moore. Russell Moore had been one of the rare vocal critics of Trump leading up to the 2016 election from the Southern Baptist Convention. And so Pastor Ancera really spoke candidly to me about that he believed that there was a gospel distortion happening around Christian nationalism within the SBC. And the SBC is representative. It's the largest Protestant denomination in America, but really representative. I would say what I found is that Christian nationalism is operating not just, of course, in SBC churches, but in churches across America. And even in some cases, operating in churches that would consider themselves to be liberal and not at all supporters of Trump. Mm-hmm. But what Christian nationalism does is it distorts the gospel. And so instead of focusing our eyes on Jesus and the example of Jesus and the forgiveness and the love and the mercy and the justice that Jesus calls us to work for, Christian nationalism instead focuses our eyes on the flag. And so it attempts to tell us that the answers to life are found not in the gospel, not in love for your God and love for your neighbor, but instead are found in political discourse. So I see, of course, Christian nationalism operating much more powerfully in a very organized way in the religious right. But I do tend to see as a reaction, there is some evidence that in churches striving to contradict and fight against that right-wing Christian nationalism, there comes sometimes an over-reliance then on the political left. And the political left begins to distort the gospel as well. So I think it's important to talk about that balance when we talk about Christian nationalism and to understand that at its root, for me, in my eyes, Christian nationalism is a form of idolatry.
So you're coming at it from more of a theological, biblical worldview. We are just going to take a very short break in this conversation with Angela Denker, who, of course, is the author of Red State Christians. Really interesting for me talking to someone like Angela, because she's the first pastor I think I've talked to in a long time, and it's really interesting to see her concerns. She's coming at the whole thing really from a pastoral point of view, and she's quite concerned about the deep divisions within American society because of the Trump vote, because of all the media manipulation on both sides of the issue. And so I'm really fascinated by where she's taken this whole conversation. So the second half of our chat is coming up in just a minute. I just wanted to mention really quick what's coming up in the next few weeks here on Mindship Podcast. The next actual episode, since this one's a bonus episode, we have got a conversation with Julie Ann Smith, who is, of course, one of the main authors on the Spiritual Sounding Board blog. She does a lot of writing about spiritual abuse and church abuse. She comes out of the homeschool Quiverful movement. So we're kind of getting back into this issue of Reconstructionism, Dominion theology, and how this actually plays out in real people's lives, people who homeschool, who have kind of bought into that vision. And it's a really fascinating conversation. So look for that episode with Julianne coming up. And then after the episode with Julianne drops, we're going to have Catherine Stewart come back. We're going to be talking about her first book, The Good News Club, How the Christian Right is Having This Sort of Stealth Assault on America's Children. That book is really kind of terrifying, but it's absolutely fascinating, the research that Catherine has done. So we're going to be talking to Catherine again. I'm really excited to talk to her again and have her back on the show. So we've got Julianne Smith, we got Catherine Stewart coming up. And in fact, speaking of amazing women authors, this month's MindShift Zoom call on the 19th of July, we have Kristen Cobes-Dumais. She's going to be our guest on our call on the 19th at 7 o'clock UK time. I am so looking forward to that because, of course, she was on the show just a few weeks back. She's the author of Jesus and John Wayne. It's all about toxic masculine evangelical biblical patriarchy and all the rest of it. So I'm really looking forward to have Kristen drop in as our guest on this month's Zoom call. And in fact, how can you become a part of that? Well, you can support the show on Patreon, which gives you access to our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. And it's in those groups that we meet and talk about all kinds of interesting topics. And there we have our monthly Mindshift Zoom calls. And in fact, the next month in August, we are going to have Julianne Smith as our guest. And I'm working now on getting Catherine Stewart booked in September. So I've got just some absolutely fantastic guests. And so this is one of the great benefits that you get for being a supporter of this show on Patreon. Help me kind of pay for all the work that I do and all the various expenses associated with running a website and the podcast and all the rest of it. So that is greatly appreciated. Anyway, let's get on back into the conversation with Angela Denker. I want to find out even more of what she learned as she traveled all over the country talking to these red state Christians who helped get Donald Trump elected. And if you recall where we left off, she had just been talking about Christian nationalism, and really her concern as a pastor was about how she saw it as a distortion of the gospel. And of course, I may have a different perspective. So let's get back into the chat. I'm coming at it from the point of view of the danger, I guess, that it poses. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. It does pose a very real danger to the most vulnerable among us, because they're actually passing legislation. They're advising Trump and passing legislation that discriminates actively against these minority segments of society. And so, yeah, there's, aside from that, may be completely against what the gospel says, but they think, well, we need to establish a Christian nation. We have to legislate these things, I guess, and make it the law.
Mm-hmm. And abortion is never mentioned in the Bible.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, it's their number plank in their platform.
Right, right. So these issues that have become sort of hallmarks of what it would mean to be a Christian nation, if we actually look at the words and the example of Jesus, a nation governed by the principles of Jesus looks very different than a nation governed by the principles of what would be called today Christian nationalism, mm-hmm. or even the Christian right. Especially looking at something like capital punishment or immigration, the treatment of refugees. All these things are written about extensively in the Bible and spoken about in churches, but it's become so twisted to focus on a few core platform issues that ironically, purposefully, I think, tend to continue to support the role of white men in power, white wealthy men in power in America. And it begins to look like that's really the goal rather than the gospel or Christianity as an end unto itself.
And I think that's where books like Taking America Back for God are so helpful, because they break down that category. And one of the things that I took away from the book was that they talk about the what they call the ambassadors, you know, the ones who are the diehard Trump voters. And they say that the most common thread in all those ambassadors is the fact that they believe in Christian nationalism. That is the number one indicator that a person was most likely to vote for Trump in 2016 and again in 2020 and continue to support him. And then in that category, you've got things like xenophobia, Islamophobia, homophobia, you know, so you just start going down the line. You go, okay, well, these people are supposed to be evangelicals, most of them, but how can they be so against all these things? But they think that's what actually being a Christian means today, I guess. I don't know. What's your take on it?
Yeah, when you asked me earlier about some of the trends that I found in my research, I did want to mention that one of the trends that I found when it came to support of Christian nationalism, and also the extent to which people were learning about Christian nationalism in their churches, as opposed to people who were learning about Christian nationalism primarily on TV or on the internet, but those beliefs were not being supported by their churches. I really saw that breakdown in some cases along regional and also along sort of denominational lines. So I spent a lot of time in Missouri with rural Christian farmers and young families. And I noticed that for them, they were really kind of upfront about saying that what they heard in church and in the pews did not support their political support of Donald Trump. And right. They really saw it as an economic vote, but they also were pretty open about saying that what I'm hearing in church, what I understand in the Bible, does not line up with what I'm hearing from Donald Trump.
But yet they may have still voted for him.
Right, right. And so I think that some of those voters, you may see that some of those voters either not vote in 2020 or they might vote for Joe Biden.
That's interesting.
I saw that in Missouri. I also saw that in Appalachia. And I really saw that also in my book. I did not travel to Wisconsin, but I spent a great I'm in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time in Wisconsin after my book came out, doing presentations on the book, meeting with people in churches in Wisconsin. And of course, when you're looking at 2020, Wisconsin is going to be hugely pivotal. And who wins the 2020 election. And so what I noticed in places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, these states that are part of the Rust Belt that have seen, you know, if you're looking at immediately after the election, a book like Hillbilly Elegy, attempting to understand American white blue collar despair and what role that played in the election. For those voters, I think that Trump's most inspiring rhetoric was not necessarily Christian nationalist rhetoric, but instead was rhetoric like drain the swamp. Mm. Some of these voters were Obama-Trump voters, voters who voted for Obama in 2008 and possibly also in 2012 and then voted for Trump. So these were change voters voting for change. And so for a lot of those voters, I also noticed, you know, if you look at those statistics, I agree with you, are incredibly compelling. Mm. But I also noticed that a lot of these voters, if you ask them, are you for gay rights? They'd be like, no, I'm not in favor of gay rights. But then they're like, well, you know, we do have a gay couple that comes to our church. We really like them. We're friends with them. They're great. Like we agree with them being able to live their lifestyle. So there's a really interesting disconnect between how people, you know, feel about issues when asked about them broadly, but then also asked about these issues locally. And I think that in these last 4 years, as communities, when it comes to issues of race, you're seeing in the fallout over George Floyd, as American families, particularly in the Rust Belt, become more diverse, more people have a family member who has come out as gay, more people have family members who are biracial, who are not white. I really think that those things are going to have an impact on voting patterns in 2020.
When people speak about it in the abstract, they might think I'm against this, but then when it's their daughter or son or someone that they actually know who is gay or of a different color or race or whatever ethnicity, suddenly it's a different story, isn't it? When you actually know someone and you go, well, this person's not evil and they don't have horns and, you know, they don't have this agenda that's trying to, you know, although the Christian right, the homosexual agenda, that is one of their biggest cards along with abortion. You know, they are just rabid about this stuff.
And when you, I think that's where the difference comes in too, whether people are attending churches that really reinforce those beliefs or whether people are sort of having those beliefs reinforced through the internet, through TV, but then maybe they're attending smaller local churches that are still denominational churches that are not preaching as explicitly political viewpoints, which is, again, the influence of that type of preaching, which is not exclusively Southern Baptist, but is heavily represented by Southern Baptists and by large evangelical megachurches. Mm-hmm. That is much more prominent in places like Texas, Alabama, Florida, which is one of the reasons why I think it's really going to be a lot harder to flip a state like Texas or Florida than it is to flip a state like Wisconsin.
The swing states are where it's at, isn't it, really? Which is what won Trump the election, wasn't it? When it came down to it, it was a handful of states where he got the electoral votes, and that's what won in the election, wasn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, voter suppression of black voters in Milwaukee. Yeah. So, yeah, it is.
Gerrymandering.
Yeah. Yeah, in North Carolina, that's another state where I've done a few events since then. That's going to be another state to watch closely. So I just think that, if nothing else, what my book does, placed alongside some of these other sociological academic studies, is gives you human stories and human faces, and gives, I think, an opportunity, because there is going to be a time when we don't, you know, I mean, we'll see when it is, but when Donald Trump is no longer president. And there's been so much. That's another thing that I just wanted to do in my book too, is that, and it's kind of hypocritical because his name's in my title, but so much of American reporting and storytelling and rhetoric has really revolved around Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And when you take him out of the equation, then how do we rebuild a country again?
Exactly.
And so I'm hoping to give Christians some tools to do that.
Well, and as they say, even though Trump will leave office, whether it's in a few months or in another 4 years, Trumpism is not going to go away. So the forces that led to him being supported by all these people, that's not going away. And as you mentioned, I wanted to circle back around too. We talk about race. You've done a lot of writing about this issue of wearing masks in this COVID outbreak. I don't know if that relates to the research that you did in your book, but what's that about? It's clearly become politicized. It's certainly become racialized. We're seeing certain communities seem to have no problem wearing masks out in public. Others are violently against it. What's that about? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I'll take that as through a journalism lens. I think, again, that so much media and reporting has become focused on Trump. And so everything is being put into a category if it's pro-Trump or anti-Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Schools, restaurants, states, and now masks become put into that category as well, when really they have nothing to do with with politics or and Donald Trump himself has put them in that category as well by sort of saying, well, I shouldn't wear one.
Right. I don't need a mask.
Yeah. So I think that that's a really sad example of the ways in which American media and American political leadership has asked people to firmly plant themselves on either side of the Trump divide, so to speak. And the consequence of that divide now is death in some cases for vulnerable people who are exposed. But I will say, you know, it's always more complex than it seems too. I live in the city of Minneapolis. In the city of Minneapolis, if you're in a public building, you have to wear a mask. In the suburbs of Minneapolis, you don't. So we visited a Home Depot in the suburbs like a couple weeks ago, and nobody's wearing a mask. But then I pastor a church in rural Minnesota, about an hour from my house, where most people are farmers. And everybody at my church, we've started very small group gatherings again for worship. It's a tiny little church. But everybody wears a mask. So, you know, you just can't break things down so simplistically between urban and rural, or there's a lot going into this. And a lot of it has to do with ego, I think, too. And a lot of it has to do with money. Mm. You know, I notice, I don't know, it definitely gets complex.
It definitely does. Well, it seems to me one way of looking at it would be, okay, we know statistically that the death toll in the African-American community is a lot higher, isn't it, than among white communities. So if you're a white person going out in public and you're thinking, well, should I wear a mask or not? For no other reason, as you say, then you could be putting a person of color's life at risk by your choice not to wear a mask. And by saying, I don't care, you're potentially condemning someone to death. So that's one way to look at it. I mean, that's pretty shocking, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I was involved with a few of the protests here in Minneapolis after George Floyd's death. And it's been really encouraging to see, A, that people attending the protests were wearing masks, were thinking about social distancing, and people got mass tested after those events. And we have not yet, you know, seen an outbreak here in Minneapolis related to those protests. So I think that there's ways that we can continue to protect one another and also look to get back into some semblance of life. My husband's an engineer, and he was involved in constructing a COVID hospital facility in Tennessee back in April. And he at that time was like, we've just got to get used to wearing masks.
This is the way it is now.
Right. And it's interesting to see people not want to do that. And the outcome is going to be really hurtful economically. You know, if we can't wear masks, then we can't resume our economy. That's really going to hurt a lot of the people that Republicans want to support, they say, like small business owners.
Mm-hmm. The classic Trump base, you know, the Fox News viewer, the people that are saying it's all a conspiracy and a hoax and Bill Gates is behind the whole thing and he's going to put a chip in your vaccine and on and on and on. I mean, they're the most vulnerable population in terms of the white people, the older population. They're the ones at most at risk from dying from COVID. So it seemed like it's counterproductive from their point of view to be minimizing it and downplaying it and brushing it off. Like, well, Trump has basically done from the beginning, hasn't he? He's just kind of said, well, it's going to go away magically. And, you know, I don't like big numbers, so we're going to do, you know, we're just going to suppress the testing. And, you know, it's just crazy.
Well, and I think that it, again, goes back to that question of trust and just the really decrease of trust in institutions, decrease of trust in one another here in America. And so a lot of the people that are suspicious of wearing masks, some of them are people who are also, you know, choosing not to vaccinate their children. And so there's a long history of distrust. And I think that again, for America to begin to dig ourselves out of this, we're going to have to find ways to rebuild trust in one another.
Sounds like your book is a helpful way to do that. Well, if you've got a minute, I've got one last question for you then. So you've done all this work, you've traveled all over the country while you're still able to anyway, before right. the outbreak. Given all this work, given all this body of research, what do you see as the future of Christianity in America? Because one of the things, the community that I'm a part of, especially on social media, sort of the ex-evangelical crowd, the people I talk to overwhelmingly when I ask them, what made you decide to walk away from organized religion or the church? And they say, it was the Trump vote in 2016. That was the last straw for me. For my story, that's why I walked away, because that was the last straw. I said, I'm done. I don't want to be associated with that, what they call Christianity anymore. It's completely unlike whatever I was raised to believe. I was a pastor. I was a Bible college teacher. I was all in, no more, because of the Trump vote, you know? So what's the future of Christianity as you see it going forward?
Well, I think I've even seen some of the change in perspective of what a successful American church might look like. You know, I came out of seminary thinking, okay, I'm going to be the first megachurch pastor who's a woman, you know, or right. wanting to
break ground.
Right. Which, you know, it's already been done, but be in those environments of, you know, and I've had experiences of preaching to thousands of people on Christmas Eve and on Easter. And for a long time, burgeoned by the church growth movement with people like Bill Hybels, like Rick Warren, the American church saw success in terms of finances and numbers and money. And I think that we've really been shown in a devastating way what the end result of that looks like. It looks like a church that rejects the teachings of Jesus in order to protect and preserve its own power and money. It looks like churches that are forced to sacrifice their position on justice in order to make enough money to pay the bills for mortgages for these massive church buildings. So when I look to the future of the church, I think that we need to look back again to the beginning of the church, in the early church, in the beginning of the New Testament, which is a church that is smaller, a church that is more nimble, a church that is poor, a church that is not, a church that does not have a lot of political power, and a church that operates outside, more outside and in resistance to the political realm, rather than seeing itself as an arm of American political power.
Mm-hmm. And just look historically, it seemed like every time, going way back to the days of Constantine, anytime the church climbs in bed with the state in one form or another, it ends up leading to corruption and abuses of all sorts. And they're worse off in the long run. And one thing I can't understand as a theologian myself, I don't understand why they can't see that. The Christian nationalists, the Tony Perkins and the James Dobsons and the Ralph Drollingers and all these people that are walking the corridors of power literally right now, advising Trump and all that. Why can't they see? Although I guess in their view, they're winning, I suppose. So they're taking dominion and they're going down that whole line, I suppose. So I guess they're winning. I don't know. Do you think they're winning?
I heard we were going to get tired of winning.
All right. You get sick of winning.
You know, Jesus didn't win. Jesus had to lose his life in order to give resurrection to everyone. So I think, and particularly for me as a Lutheran and as someone of German heritage, we really have a powerful example of the difference between aligning your church with the state and aligning your church with Jesus. So I think that money and power are blinding, and they have been for white American Christians for a long time. Mm-hmm. And we really have to take a step back and look to the leadership of leaders in the Black church, leaders in the Latino church, leaders who are LGBTQ, in order to be reminded what Christian leadership looks like from the position of Jesus.
Hmm. It's certainly not the guys that are in charge right now who are winning. Well, it sounds like your book is a good place to start, isn't it? Because it's not, doesn't sound like it's like a Trump apologist sort of book where, hey, you know, I'm helping these people, you know, speak their minds so that we can feel sorry for them. It's not like that. It sounds like it's a good way to increase dialogue. So I hope people will pick up your book. I was going to ask you too, how can people find you? Where can they get a hold of your book, and how can they find you on social media?
Yeah, so my book is available wherever books are sold. So it's on Amazon. It's available. I've had a lot of European readers and readers in the UK, so it should be available overseas as well as bookstores in the United States. If you have a local bookstore that's doing curbside pickup or that is open, support those local bookstores. Available in a lot of libraries. You can find me on Twitter at Angela_Danker or AngelaDanker.com.
And obviously you've got stuff. I've read some of the articles you've got in the Washington Post, and you were on CNN. I watched that clip. So you're out there. If people want to find other things that you've written besides your book, go on Google, do a search, and they will find you out there. So thank you so much, Angela. I've absolutely enjoyed talking to you. I really appreciate your point of view. It's something, honestly, I don't hear that much because I'm talking to people that are, you know, they're talking about Christian nationalism, dominion theology, warnings, and all this stuff. So I think you represent a really good, valuable point of view that is definitely needed out there today. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Clint. It was a lot of fun.